Welcome to the Commentary Magazine podcast, day one of the Trump era, Wednesday, November 9th, 2016. I'm John Podhoretz, the editor of Commentary. You can follow me on Twitter at JPodhoretz. To my left, Abe Greenwald, our senior editor, whom you can follow on Twitter at Abe Greenwald. And to my right, Noah Rothman, our assistant online editor, whom you can follow at Noah C. Rothman on Twitter. You can like us on Facebook at Commentary, and you can follow Commentary at Commentary on Twitter. You might ask, why should you follow us today, of all days, since we have been rather confidently presuming over the course of the last 2-3 months, that 4 months, that Donald Trump could not possibly win the presidency, and he is now won the presidency in an earthquake moment in what is easily the most, the largest upset victory, if you consider where he was and who he is and who his rival was and what happened in the Republican primaries, the largest upset victory maybe in American history. So we're going to try to go through what it was that we got wrong, why we got it wrong, whether we should even have been arguing and discussing the question of whether or not Trump was electable or not electable in the first place, and where things go from here. So Noah Rothman, we were just talking about the question of the composition of the Trump winning electorate versus the composition of the Hillary Clinton losing electorate. And the theory that the Trump campaign and the Trumpers had been going on for a year and a half was that he was going to produce this not invisible vote of, from people who hadn't voted in 50 years. Do we think that's what happened based on what we're seeing?
Well, not really. First of all, I want to say, just to get it out of the way, that I was the wrongest person to ever wrong. My wrongness is inexcusable, so wrong. I'm in very voluminous and good company there, and that's cold comfort. But it turns out that just basically, if you were to sum it up in a sentence, Republicans who were skeptical of Trump from the very beginning didn't trust the data they were seeing in the primaries, and they corrected for that, overly so, by being very credulous about the data they were seeing in the general, which was wrong. Now,
right. So in other words, the polling in the primaries was correct. The polling in the general was
not
incredibly wrong. That is to say that the Trump was at 43.2% in the Real Clear Politics average yesterday afternoon. And he now appears to be at about, what, 48.7. So he basically outperformed, or 48 or something like that. So he was almost 5 points higher than the Real Clear Politics average had him at. And, of course, the margin of victory, Hillary was supposed to be winning by about 2.5 and nationally, and they're basically tied. So that was within the frame of the margin of
error. But the distribution of that win is remarkable because it's lopsided in the places where you would expect the Trump vote to come from, particularly the upper Midwest, the Rust Belt, the former industrial states of the upper Midwest. There were polls of Wisconsin and Michigan that were gold standard polls that were not wrong ever, that predicted Hillary Clinton winning but safely by 6-7 points, slightly lower than Barack Obama, but not much. And Donald Trump easily won those states. He won Pennsylvania. This is a victory that hasn't been replicated since 1988. Now, are these a bunch of Trump voters who were selective about responding to the polls? There might be something to that. We're not entirely sure just how much that accounts for this victory, and I wouldn't want to say it's nothing. There probably is something to that, a response bias sort of thing. But Hillary Clinton's voters didn't show up.
Right, so this is the key.
To almost 7 million voters who voted for Barack Obama, just didn't appear.
Well, there are two ways of looking at that. So right now, Trump is on track to about equal or somewhat better Mitt Romney's 61 million total votes. He probably will end up somewhere around 62 million, I think. This vote rolls in as the absentee ballots are counted, the military ballots, stuff that's counted actually much later than people realize. And a lot of that is in states like California, and where there's only mail-in stuff like Oregon and Washington and Colorado. So there's a lot more votes to be counted. It's unlikely to sort of shift the balance of anything, so Hillary Clinton will almost certainly prevail by a tiny margin in the popular vote, and he will win maybe as many as 300 electoral votes. That's not, I think, entirely clear as yet as we speak. What all of this says, though, is that he got the Romney vote and a little more. In 2008, Barack Obama got 70 million votes. Hillary Clinton is going to get 60 to 61 million votes. So it's not a 7 million loss. It's a 9 million loss from 08. It's a 5 million loss from 12. Where'd those voters go? They didn't vote. I mean, maybe some of them did, and maybe a lot of people died, and you don't know who votes for who or where. But, I mean, there's no sign that a bunch of Obama voters went and voted for Trump. There's no sign that a bunch of Republican voters voted for Hillary and they were replaced by these never voting people who haven't voted in 40 years in the upper Midwest. Trump got the Republican vote plus a little bit from 2012, but distributed differently, as Noah said, meaning he got enough votes in Wisconsin, Michigan, and Pennsylvania, and Ohio to win those states. But a lot of that is the tanking of the Obama coalition for Hillary. And the tanking of the Obama coalition for Hillary means African-American voters. So it appears, for example, that in Philadelphia, she got something like 200,000 fewer votes in 2016 than Barack Obama got in 2012. And what that says about the Democratic coalition going forward is it's really not clear whether or not the Democratic Party has a naturally existing majority or plurality of voters without an African American at the top of the ticket.
Or a celebrity. I mean, a lot of this had to do with personality. Barack Obama.
Well, Hillary Clinton's a celebrity. She's not a popular celebrity, but yeah. She was. The weird thing about this race is that Republicans nominated a person who was nearly equal to Hillary Clinton in celebrity. Hillary Clinton is the most famous person ever to run for president. First lady, secretary of state, huge best-selling author, a figure in public life for 25 years, hugely famous, enormously full of celebrity. But not a particularly likable person.
But just being famous didn't do it for Barack Obama either. He couldn't get a Democrat elected to save his life.
But he became famous for being famous. She was a quarter century famous. But maybe a lot of her fame was negative fame.
Well, what she was not was a charismatic celebrity. I mean, she was a celebrity in the literal definition of being that famous. But she didn't wield that kind of, you know.
As I said, I think on the last podcast or two podcasts ago, she, in 2013, when she left office in September of 2013, January of 2013, she in Gallup had an approval rating of 68%. She ends up 3.5 years later with an approval rating somewhere around 37%. So the story of Hillary Clinton is a story of Hillary Clinton's own behavior, her own conduct, and her own presence in political combat, taking her from being the most popular political figure in America to among the least popular political figures in America. That's her. That's all on her. Trump has nothing to do with it. Obama has nothing to do with it. Hillary has everything to do with that.
I have to think that Trump has to do with it in the following sense. I think his preposterousness turned out to be a great asset for him in that I think people thought there's no way at the end of all this, this guy is really going to win. Do we really have to turn out to fight this? Is this?
I think there's a lot to that.
You know,
because we all assumed that the Democratic machine would roar to life, right, and bring out all these voters saying, that yeah. Democrats have been managed to get to the polls mm-hmm. for quite some time. And to really fully understand the scope of what happened last night, you can't just look at the presidential level, because it was a wave election. It was a Republican wave election, the first presidential wave election for Republicans in many years. The destruction of the Democratic Party is near total. Republicans held on to their Senate, and they're looking at a really favorable map in 2018. Joe Manchin is from West Virginia, where Donald Trump won by 20 points, is already flirting with pulling a Jim Jeffords, flipping party registration.
Right, meaning he'll go from being a Democrat to being a Republican.
They held the House. They picked up three gubernatorial seats for a grand total of 33, and they could virtually pass constitutional amendments on their own at this point. And the legislative down ballots, like going at the legislative level, which, by the way, Barack Obama had made his personal mission to try to repair some of the damage that he'd done to the legislative level.
State legislative level.
He made 150 endorsements. He went out and stumped for candidates at the state level. He really tried his best to repair that damage. And the extent of it is remarkable. Democrats lost the Kentucky House, which was their last southern legislature. Republicans took over both chambers of government in Iowa and Minnesota. The Democrats had a little bit of success in Nevada, where they managed where they managed to retain their pressure. No,
at
their,
this point, you
pressure.
Should just take a stand, make a case for Nevada.
I was going to say NV. Yeah.
By the way, Nevada country. Is the only state in which it appears that what we assumed the Democrats were going to do, they did. That is to say, they had a get-out-the-vote machine backed by unions and internal political machines and all that that got wildly successful in generating an early vote, disproportionately Hispanic or Latino in nature. And not only did they win, Hillary won that state, and the Senate candidate, the Democratic Senate candidate, Masto, won over a pretty good Republican candidate, Joe Heck, and they lost, and the Democrats won the state legislature. So that is that state. If other states had been like Nevada, if Florida had been like Nevada, if Ohio had been like Nevada, if Pennsylvania had been like Nevada, that was what we assumed was the national picture of the Democratic Party's machine. And it turns out that the machine broke down, or I mean literally it broke down. If she loses 250,000 votes off Obama in 2012, that means that the machine didn't get the people out. Obama got the people out. It wasn't that, you know, all this stuff about mechanics, I've been learning about this for 20 years, how they do it, and now you add big data and you use iPads and you do this and you do that, and it's all nonsense. Because And this, is, of course, is the revolutionary thing of that the entire political system is going to have to digest. Trump won spending $200 million. Hillary spent $600 million. She spent, what is that? Do math for me. She spent three times as much as he did. And they got exactly the same amount of vote nationally. And they only got the same amount of vote nationally because she ran up high totals in places where she didn't have to get out the vote. California and New York. There's no get out the vote in California and New York.
And there's people talking about messaging, like, well, she focused too much on Donald Trump's attacks or his rhetoric. He should have been talking about Barack Obama's achievements and the auto bailout.
Yeah, well, except let's put it this way. It's very simple. Trump comes down the escalator and he's got this one thing to say, which is make America great again. What did she run on? In other words, if you had to say what was Trump? What was Trump's message? It was on a hat. Make America great again. What was hers? I'm with her. Her message was her. You know, we keep thinking that Trump was the personality candidate, and indeed, I think he largely was. And you can't separate any of this out. But he actually came in this race. This is how he vanquished those 16 Republicans. Because the 60 Republicans were, I'm going to do a little bit of this and a little bit of that, and I'm going to try to get the moderate conservative lane, and then I'll move over into the very conservative lane. I'll talk about this for the abortion people and that for the gun people and this for these people, and I'll pick up this, and I'll be second here and third here and something like that. And he had no lane. He wasn't interested in lanes. He wasn't going. He had a big
In fact,
simple message.
He got all that stuff horribly wrong. Whenever he was questioned on any of those items, right. he was all over right. the map.
Because you know. His point was, this country's going to the dogs. I'm going to make it great again. I'm going to fix it. I alone can fix. Country's going to the dogs fit very much. It was very comfortably, you know, in keeping with the general mood of the Republican Party and the Republican primary voter. Who, you know, again, he only won a plurality and not a majority, absolute majority of the Republican primary vote. But there it is. This is who he is. This is what he said. And she, like everybody else, including the best Republican candidates like Marco Rubio, had no message. She had no purpose. She had no thing to promise anybody except she was going to break the glass ceiling and she was going to do this bit of liberalism over here and that bit of liberalism over here and this nice thing over here and do this about comparable worth there and do this about children here and pay for college and do this. And he's like, everything's terrible. I'm going to renegotiate trade deals. I'm going to bomb the hell out of ISIS. I'm going to make the country great again. He was big. She was small. He was playing, you know, she was playing small ball. He was shooting. He was aiming for the fences. And everything that we didn't like about him, everything that we, and I would still argue, he is not fit to be president of the United States. He's vulgar. He's crass. He's disgusting. He's a bad role model for children. He's a liar. His business practices are outrageous and unseemly. You know, he defrauded people. He's awful. Right? There literally is nothing that I would take back that I've said about him or anything that I've written about him that I would take back. But he said, I am the vessel for your anger, and I am promising you victories. I'm going to go around. I'm going to win things. I'm going to beat the Chinese. I'm going to beat ISIS. I'm going to do this. And who is she? She's just a crook. Well, she is just a crook. She was Secretary of State. She ran Foggy Bottom as a cash machine for her family foundation, whose distribution of monies is still a matter of great wonderment and confusion. We now know that, like, you know, her husband, because of the foundation, was getting weird million-dollar gifts from foreign governments, and then she was endangering national security because of her efforts to hide from discovery all of this untoward behavior. So he's a crook. She's a worse crook. So they cancel each other out. They're both crooks. You know, he's unseemly. She's unseemly because she's lying in front of the American people about the emails and, you know, behaving very badly in that sense. So what's left? So they cancel each other out on the bad character front. And then he's got something to say and she doesn't. That's how I adjudicate this.
I don't even know if they canceled each other out. I mean, not just us, but most of the country said over and over that he did not have a temperament befitting a president. And they voted for him anyway.
Right, because they thought, in the end, all things considered, she was worse.
Right.
Now, here's what we don't know, and here's where it gets complicated, and here's where liberal attacks are going to get confusing, and you know, we don't know how much of this is because she was a woman. We don't know how much of this is because he was appealing to, he was doing dog whistles on race and on, you know, other things. I mean, and to say that it's nothing would be wrong. It's not nothing, and it's way more than anybody really should be comfortable with. And on the other hand, what did she do? Her entire candidacy was premised on the notion that she was going to get 95% of the African-American vote just for being a Democrat, that she was going to benefit from this gigantic gender gap just because she was a woman, that she was going to get this enormous Hispanic vote just because he was bad on immigration in her lights. Well, those were all presumptions that apparently turned out to be not true. Why did they turn out to be not true? Because she was a person of equal bad character in the eyes of everybody. And when you cancel those things out, then the question is, what are you left with? What you're left with is one very discomforting fact, which is Trump won by winning an overwhelming majority of the white vote. Right? We've been told for years the white vote is on the decline, right? It was 70, it was 84% in 1980. It was 74% then. Now it's 72. Now it's going to be 70. But, you know, 70% of the vote is a lot. 70% of the country is a lot of the country. And if you spend 40 years telling Americans that they're supposed to think of themselves not as Americans, but as African Americans, or not as Americans, but as women, or not as Americans, but as Latinos, at some point, the largest element of them is going to look at itself and decide, you know what? Identity politics is how I'm taught. This is what we're learning in school. This is what they're teaching their kids in school. I have an identity, too. I'm a white guy. I'm a white guy, and I'm getting screwed, and I'm voting for the guy who says, you're a white guy, and you're getting screwed. You're not allowed to do that, supposedly, because we white guys are not supposed to have ethnic or gender or racial consciousness. But it is inevitable, if that's how you run a country, that every group is going to decide that it's if what makes you special is the color of your skin, then white is going to become a color of your skin.
But that is the gravest tragedy.
It is.
This election for Republicans is that they have now become an identity politics party. It is inevitable. They have enjoyed miraculous political success, more so than they've experienced in the last 30 years, by turning white working class voters into an interest group, just like any other interest group. And they voted as a bloc. And by doing so, they won a bigger political victory than any Republican has since 1988.
Electorally. I mean, George W. Bush got 51% of the vote, but he only got 286 electoral votes.
Yeah, that map is going to look real red, and that at the end of the day, and that is going to be the beginning, middle, and end of the argument moving forward, is that identity politics works, and now both parties are identity politics parties, and probably progressive parties that do not defer to small government, to private sector.
Well, of course, because if you govern by interest group, then you have to deliver the goods to your interest group, and it's a zero-sum game. And here's the interesting problem. If your interest group is the, you know, plurality or the majority of the country, boy, that's expensive. I mean, it's one thing to deliver goods, not that in fact we do this that much, to be honest, in this country. It's not so easy. You can't really write legislation to favor one group over another, despite what people think. But, you know, how do you help the white working class? You have to increase their benefits from the government in some fashion. Well, if the benefits that you want to increase are targeted at them, those benefits are going to be colossal. There's so many people. Well, it's like a huge number of people you've got
to
serve.
But what has he promised? He's promised to reopen things like the Pennsylvania shipyards, which have been closed for almost 40 years. I mean, that's just not happening.
Right.
Like, there's a lot of things that he can't deliver. And right. that's the second tragedy of this thing, is that there's going to be a lot of disappointment.
But here are two things that he can deliver, okay? Not deliver, but that he can back and support and fight for, that Hillary had declared she was going to shut down. One is the coal industry, and the other is the domestic fracking oil industry, right? Right now, we have this fight going on in Dakota. People are, like, occupying areas of, you know, near an Indian reservation to prevent a pipe from being laid down to, you know, to have natural gas flow through the United States. We have wars on the, you know, fracking industry in Pennsylvania and in New York and all sorts of places. And, of course, Hillary Clinton literally said, I'm going to close the coal industry down. The Democratic Party, as an environmentalist party, has decided that coal is evil and fracking is evil. Well, who works in coal and fracking? White men with high school and non-high school educations who have strong backs and who are willing to do very difficult manual labor for good salaries and suffer the consequences, health consequences, and physical consequences of doing so. This was the one bright spot in the industrial economy, was the fact that coal came back to some degree, steel came back to some degree, not anywhere near where it was, and that this entire fracking industry was created out of whole cloth in 2007 and following. And the Democratic Party went to war on these industries, and the people who are in them and are related to people in them and are related to people who would like to work in them and see them as the future and understand that they can make $28 an hour where they can't make $7.80 an hour working, flipping a pizza somewhere. This was very big, and no wonder they voted as a group. But I'm saying, in that sense, those people had every reason to do whatever they could. As look at West Virginia. Interesting story about West Virginia. West Virginia coal state. The West Virginia state that was a reliable Democratic state. It's the state that won John F. Kennedy the presidency in 1960, right? Hillary Clinton got fewer votes in 2016 in the presidential race than she got winning West Virginia in the primary, the Democratic primary in 2008. That is to say that Democrats voted for her in the primary in 2008, who by 2016 weren't touching her with a 10-foot pole. She got 28% of the vote in West Virginia last night. Why? Because she said she was going to shut West Virginia down and put it into a state of permanent economic depression.
And look, you know, if Hillary and if the Democrats, they thought they were offering the inclusive option. They were stronger together. But they were not at all inclusive because they had completely left out this segment. In fact, waged war on them in this way with serious consequences.
I think the West Virginia example is a really good one because it's not like this happened overnight. I mean, the only anecdote I remember from Karl Rove's first book was one in which he was telling a younger staffer in 2000 that if you devote any time to flipping West Virginia, you're fired. Because West Virginia is a blue state. It's always been a blue state. It's always going to be a blue state. And West Virginia went Republican in 2000 and shocked everybody. And we wouldn't have had to worry about Florida if it hadn't. And that was the result of what I think the Democratic Party has become when we were talking about earlier off air, was this sense that it is culturally ascendant liberalism is the glue binding this disparate group of blocks and ethnic and economic interest groups into one cohesive whole. The idea that they are ascendant and that there are some sort of ideological enemies out there over whom they can lord their ascendancy in the cultural sphere, in movies and television and film and in music and that sort of thing. There's no policy preferences that bind this group of individuals. And as you said,
there are policy preferences that bind them. That's the point. They're culturally liberal policy preferences. They're environmentalism, for example, which is not considered by environmentalists to be a culturally liberal policy, but is culturally liberal in the sense that it is an assertion of an idea about how the world should function and what the purity of the planet is supposed to be versus...
But that
versus the labor that people have to go to keep their machines going and have.
But that there is so amorphous and ill-defined that it doesn't constitute a policy preference. I mean, it's sort of something that you can stamp onto it whatever you want after the fact.
Can I tell you a Joe Manchin story? Because I think this is pretty interesting. I was at a meeting with Joe Manchin after one of the horrible events. I think it was Sandy Hook. So Joe Manchin was the governor of West Virginia, became a senator, right? And so Manchin is a guy from a state in which if you say that you have only 100 guns, they throw you out of office. Like it is a gun nut, gun heavy, gun-loving state. And Manchin took on the task of seeing if there were some way on earth that the Democratic Party's desires to institute some form of gun control after Sandy Hook could find purchase with the NRA, with whom, National Rifle Association, of whom he was a life member and who had considered him an ally and all that, except that he was a Democrat. And of course, the thing was that he went to them and said, well, what if we do this, or what if we do that, or what if we do the other thing? And the NRA said, you're great, we're not doing any of that. You know, what are you talking about? You're just trying to control our guns, you're trying to control our bullets, whatever. And then he would go back to talk to Chuck Schumer and Harry Reid and various other people and Obama. And he would say, well, you have to understand what Second Amendment people are like. they're like this, they're like that, they're like the other thing. And it was like he was, and he said it was like saying to them, you have to understand what child molesters are like. That's what he said, he Manchin said, and that was the perspective from which after Sandy Hook, and indeed I think we all know this from people, friends of ours, liberals, who loathe guns, that their loathing of guns is a kind of moral, is a deep morally held view, and that they believe that people who don't feel this way have some deep monstrous love of violence and evil in them or something like that. And there was Manchin just trying to see if there was some possible way that there could be a conversation in which Democrats and Republicans and conservatives and liberals and Second Amendment people and non-Second could discuss this. And he threw up his hands and went away. And it was an early sign of what Marco Rubio learned about the Gang of Eight, that is, that there are some matters on which there is no possible conversation at present.
Well, because the consequences of reaching a conclusion that's mutually amenable are terrible to the people who like the issue. I mean, Republicans who didn't like Gang of Eight really preferred having the issue there so they could, you know, rally their troops around
it. And the NRA.
Democrats.
The NRA exists.
Every time there's a shooting, Democrats accuse people, the NRA in particular, of having blood on its hands. Right. They like that. They appreciate
having
like that mobilizing.
It works for their people, and the NRA likes it, and it works for their people. So, you know, we have this divide that is unbreachable. But if you're Joe Manchin and it's 2017, your state has just gone 72% for Trump, and you have to run in 2018, and you are a very popular politician in your state, and there is some ticket splitting, but you could be in the majority and then deliver some goods to your people. Why on earth would he stay a Democrat now? I mean, he is the leader of the Democratic Party in his state, but I have no idea why he would stay a Democrat.
But now, see, my question is, so the Democrats have sort of lived by and now died by the sword of identity, and they seem now, at least in the immediate response of Trump's victory, to soothe themselves with identity to further this. You know, I mean, and obviously, as John touched on before, there's not nothing to it, but they are solely retreating to this is about having a woman-hating, minority-hating country. This is a hateful country that is hateful to
voter suppression.
Right, exactly. Yes, and they're going to further paint themselves into a corner, or is the polarization of both sides just going to now exacerbate?
I thought Democrats were so good at balkanizing this country that Republicans could never effectively mimic their efficacy on that issue, and I was totally wrong.
You're not wrong in the long term, because again, what did you say that Trump promised? He promised to reopen the Pennsylvania shipyards. He can't reopen the Pennsylvania shipyards. If Barack Obama promised that the oceans were going to heal and the world was going to heal by his election, Donald Trump has promised a revitalization of the heavy industry in the United States that he cannot effect. And therefore, just as progressives have found themselves increasingly disappointed in the Obama era, so disappointed that in fact they went 44% in the Democratic Party for Bernie Sanders, and he won nearly half the states in the primaries and caucuses, so too are Trump voters very likely in 2020 to say, what did I get? What did you give me?
Well,
you made all these promises and I got nothing.
Here's the downside of that, though, is that what Donald Trump has promised are scapegoats. His very first item under the establishment was trade war with China. Right. That means
Noah's referring to his website where he had his issues
page.
Right. So the first issue was the establishment. And if you clicked on it, it was how I'm going to destroy the establishment. Right. And the second issue was
trade war in that language, quotes, trade war with China. Now that the practical effects of what would be a series of escalating, cascading tariffs over goods if we were to pursue that kind of a course. And there's evidence that you could do it. Barack Obama imposed a tire tariff very early on in his administration.
George W. Bush imposed a steel tariff in 2002.
And the effects of those are very predictably to make those costs higher and to make labor in those industries harder. So they backfire. And that's what we're going to see. We're probably going to see, if that happens, and it might, we're going to see the goods that we export to China get fewer people being employed in those sectors, and the goods that we import from China are going to get more expensive, and there's a lot of them. So what we're going to see then is not necessarily a bunch of American voters who say, well, golly, this was terrible policy. They're going to say, China's screwing us. They're going to say, we're getting a bad deal from China. And they're going to go to the polls and vote against China. They're not going to go to the polls and say, well, you know what? It would be really great if we had a laissez-faire economic system that really respected open borders and free trade.
Well, there is the progressivism you're talking about. So there is a Trumpian nationalist progressivism that will do this on trade, conceivably, while simultaneously spending $1 trillion, as he said last night, on a giant infrastructure program to make our roads and bridges amazing and have really great airports. Now, I think that, the latter is more likely to be imposed on the country than the former, simply because Trump, as a builder, will be most comfortable with the idea that what he wants to do is, you know, order steel and get, you know, and get things going and build some buildings that could be called Donald Trump Airport all over the country. I still say that the interesting problem is what Trump has overpromised. What did he say in those amazing rally speeches to Republicans? He stopped saying it, but he would end the speeches by saying, we're going to win, and we're going to win, and we're going to win, and you're going to win so much that you're going to come to me and say, Mr. Trump, we're sick of winning so much. We can't win. Let's win a little less this time. Well, that's really nice, but here's one example of winning or not winning. So we launch a trade war with China, and there's some kind of patriotic hoo-ha in relation to it and all of that. That, you know, really riles up his voters, and he does a really good job of riling up his voters. And then China bombs Taiwan. Or China builds another, you know, 15 islands, invents another 15 islands, and claims, you know, 200 miles of the nautical, 200 nautical miles of the South China Sea as its own protectorate.
Or closer to home, China attacks the American electric grid in a cyber attack.
Right, but okay, but that's a what I'm saying is something that sort of fits more plausibly with their behavior at OPM. Present.
The OPM attack.
Well, the OPM attack. That's right. The attack that exposed the Social Security numbers of almost everyone who had ever worked in government. Right. But that's a good point. But I'm saying they're already doing what I'm talking about doing. They're already building these. They're already making these, you know, sand pits or not sand pits, what do you call it? Like Fire Island, what is it? It's a sandbar.
Landfill
sandbars, and claiming them as Chinese territory. Because they're not just going to take a trade war lying down. I mean, he thinks they will, and you know, he thinks maybe he could make an agreement where they agree to buy X or Y amount of American goods, and then he can claim that he's had a great victory. I'm still saying that these solutions are not really plausible, and while maybe he can get 4 years out of it, their lives have to get better. If it's 4 years later and their lives aren't better, what happens then?
We've spent the last 5-6 years negotiating a 12-nation free trade zone spanning the Pacific, South America, Latin America, South America, and the Asian Pacific region, designed to hem in China because China is an economic powerhouse. And if you believe Stephen Walt's theory of international relations and alliance structures, big aspiring hegemonies in their regions have two effects on their satellite powers. One is they force them to give up the ghost and bandwagon along with them in order to keep themselves safe, or to balance against them with the biggest guy in the room, and we're the biggest guy in the room. And we're seeing the breakdown of that in Asia, if you believe, as I believe, what happened in the Philippines with Rodrigo Duterte giving up on the American alliance and bandwagoning with Russia and Beijing is a sign of things to come, and not just the evidence of a nationalistic wave and weird personalities coming to the fore in a lot of these nations. I think that has a lot to do with the political pressures that are on the Philippine people. And if this deal, which doesn't look like it's going to go through now, collapses and we lose the prestige associated with backing out of a deal that was negotiated in secret between 12 member nations all over the world, really complex deal, and we just give up on it, there's going to be a backlash in Asia. And where do they turn?
Well, I mean, obviously, the TPP is dead. So even saying if, there's no if, TPP is dead. And then the question is, Trump has now said that he will abrogate the North American Free Trade Agreement. The largest free trade zone in the world, you know, the largest and most complex free trade zone in the world, and he's going to end it because it's the worst deal ever. What are the consequences of that? We can't even, you can't even game that out, because that's then related to the building of the wall and making Mexico pay for the wall. And are we, we're going to like actually, you know, we're actually going to sort of go a little bit to war with Mexico. I mean, some version of little bits of war. And, what all of that does to improve the lives of the people who he convinced he could help because they feel like they've been left behind is not clear. But there is another group of people that he got, and this is the important thing. He got 90-95% of the Republican electorate, right? He got the Romney vote, and that apparently is enough because Hillary's Democratic vote cratered. Well, so if he got the Romney vote, distributed in a different sort of way, I mean, nationally. He got a lot of middle class and upper middle class people. What is it that they want? What do they want?
Fewer regulations, which he has also promised.
Right. I mean, you know, he's promised this mammoth tax cut, which will be very hard to effect because it's too big, even for, you know, crazy tax cutters like us. I mean, who think that, I mean, a corporate tax of 15% is actually a pretty good idea in theory. But, you know, again, the question is there a consistent set of policies that he will enact with a Republican Congress that will materially improve the lives of Americans? If so, he will be a revolutionary figure in American politics. We are going to enter a period like the Jacksonian era that can be named after him, in which we have a whole new set of ideas about how the country is going to run and who is running it, which was what happened with Andrew Jackson, or he's going to fail, and he's going to fail hugely. Who will be the vehicle of his failure? That's the question that I would like to pose to Noah, because Noah and I have a disagreement about who the Democrats could put up in 2020 that could take him down. Noah has a man. I have a woman.
I do?
Don't you?
Well, okay. I'll examine my thinking about this, if that's where you want to go.
No, but I'm saying, okay, I'm being too cutesy. Okay, Noah said Kanye West.
Oh.
And I'm literally saying Oprah Winfrey. I'm not figuratively saying Oprah Winfrey. I'm saying if the world that we are now in is that somebody who is world famous, who can get a crowd just by announcing that she's coming, and who is beloved of many people, she has every quality that you could possibly want in a candidate for the Democratic Party. She's a woman, she's black, she's lovable, she's outrageous, she's the richest, she is, unlike Donald Trump, a billionaire many times over. She could self-fund her campaign, she can go anywhere, she is partially responsible for Barack Obama lapping Hillary Clinton in 2008 when she endorsed him in October, and they had a rally in South Carolina that won him South Carolina.
She is extraordinarily charismatic.
She's smart as a whip, and she's very left-wing.
Well, I was borrowing from my former colleague at Hot Air Blog, a pseudonymous blogger by the name of Ala Pundit, who's a very bright guy and a great writer, and you should follow him if you haven't. And the truth of that is that the lessons we're probably going to learn here from the Democratic side of this thing is that centrism, or centrism as defined as the maintenance of the status quo, is a loser. It's milquetoast. It doesn't get anybody jazzed up, and it loses national elections, particularly when you're facing a celebrity. So the antidote to that is not only celebrity, but progressivism, the kind of progressivism that is exemplified by Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders that gets has evidence that it can get the blood flowing, even if that doesn't matter how big that constituency is. If you can manifest that kind of excitement in a room, in a stadium, that's one of the lessons that we're going to learn. It makes it a lot easier to learn it by the fact that this Democratic Party is now a rump, coastal, urban party that has no blue dogs. It has no centrists. The party's been relegated to a position that it hasn't occupied in many decades. So this decision gets really easy. You need a celebrity. It needs to be progressive. And an ideologically homogenous party like the Democratic Party has a lot less compunction, or a lot less, more compunction, less fear about nominating somebody like that.
Abe? But I think there's one note of caution here for the Democrats and the going down the political celebrity road, which is that I think part of what happened last night is a reaction to the culture, our current left liberal celebrity culture, constantly drumming the same political messages down the throats of the American, drum something down someone's throat, but drumming into the heads of the American people. I don't know that they're going to do well by picking someone who has been standing on a soapbox since the 80s about certain issues. I mean there was kind of
why Oprah is such a genius idea, and I've been saying it for 2 years. Oprah doesn't have an issue. Oprah doesn't have issues. She has feelings.
True.
She's like, you could be your best self. You can open yourself up to so many possibilities. And if you're an Oprah watcher, she doesn't have her show anymore, but the big thing that she would do is the studio audience would come in and she would say, and you get a car, and you get a car, and you get a car. Well, that's Trumpism.
Yes.
Come to my rally. You know what? Under the seat in row C, in the stadium, AAC, there's a ticket, and you're going to get a car in the parking lot.
And it's all the revenge of the 80s now, where we're living in the zombie 80s.
That's all coming back.
I mean, for all we know, she was at a Trump wedding as well.
Yeah, I mean, how do we know? The whole point here. Oh, and here's the final point.
She has to be recruited. Kanye actually wants to run.
You want to bet she has to be recruited?
How old is she, by the way?
She came in 62? 63? Anyway, she came into American politics in 2008 endorsing Obama. He was 25 points behind Hillary. He became a famous person in a week, and he won the state in which they had the big rally. She tipped the scale of the election. Obama thanked her in Grant Park on the night of his election and said it all started with Oprah. You get a little taste. So what Oprah doesn't need is what Trump needed, and which is the other hidden story of this campaign, is that Trump, together with Roger Stone, using on the one his genius, crazy, evil, Machiavellian political aide, Trump not only had his own celebrity because of The Apprentice, but from 2010 onward went into the fever swamps and the catfish resting places at the, in the shallows of American media. And, like the National Enquirer, Alex Jones, World Wrestling Federation, going on these weird talk shows you've never heard of, doing the birther stuff, all of that, that ended up winning him this kind of bizarre proletarian audience that when he got into the race in 2015, suddenly out of nowhere, he's got 20%, 25% of the prime. From whom? Well, you know who it was from? It was from people who listened to that stuff, who were all Republicans, and who had come to know and love him while everybody else was laughing at him. Oprah doesn't need that. Oprah is that. Oprah had her own television network. Oprah has her own magazine. She was she's the person with the highest popularity rating in the history of television, the highest Q rating in the history of television. And if Michael Bloomberg is a plausible candidate for the presidency, Oprah Winfrey is an even more plausible candidate for the presidency. So keep your eyes open. Democratic Party is hollowed out, which means that there are no... Name a political figure aside from Michelle Obama, who's the other name that's going to be floated around, who could run in 2020, assuming that, you know, Trump is going to run again, and that name somebody that they can recruit from their ranks, except for Elizabeth Warren. You can't. And what's more, the big question is, if you lose 7 million voters and 50% of them or 60 or 70% of them are African American, the lesson you take is, I'm going to need an African American at the top of the ticket. And who is that? There are about three people. There's Cory Booker, there's Deval Patrick, and there is Oprah Winfrey. And there's Kanye West, if you think that Kanye West... I would have said Kanye West couldn't do it because he seems to be bipolar and deeply troubled, but I wouldn't necessarily say that those were words that didn't apply to Donald Trump either. So,
I mean, how much of the new aspects of what Trump brought to our presidential election is going to stay with us? Namely, from here on out, will dirty laundry matter? Will ignorance matter? Will humiliating secrets exposed matter? I mean, are people going to continue to not care at the end of the day, or is there going to be a return to sort of a certain bar?
It doesn't matter if you run as a purely revanchist, culturally anxious force that is going to seek an exact revenge on your enemies.
So there's going to be two rules.
I think Abe is onto something here. I said the other day that Trump will now make it possible for politicians in the future not to release their tax returns.
Right.
Nobody wants to release his tax returns. It's the most invasive thing you can possibly do. Well, since because of Watergate, it then became the practice of politicians to show that they weren't in the pocket of special interests to release their tax returns. Well, Trump's in the pocket of special interests. He never paid taxes, whatever it is. He hasn't released his tax returns. Why should anybody ever again release their tax returns? The press is going to push them to release their tax returns. They'll say, look, I am not releasing my tax returns. President Trump didn't release his tax returns. Why should anybody ever do that again? Similarly, you're going to go do all this oppo. You're going to spend all this money where you're not, because obviously people didn't do that much of it. You're going to like go and find people who claim that someone raped them. And then he's going to say, well, what do you want from me? Not only did Donald Trump do X, Bill Clinton did Y, and you're coming at me with this? Like, we've had two presidents in the United States do this.
Yeah, but that double standards happen all the time, and then the effect of a double standard is to be a single standard, which is certain people can get away with certain things and others cannot.
One of the fears in the Republican Party, think about this. One of the fears in the Republican Party was always that if your personal peccadilloes were exposed, the Republican electorate would rise up against you because it is Christian and moral, and it maybe even it's hypocritical, but it doesn't like adultery, it doesn't like this, it doesn't like that. According to the exit polls, which are probably screwed up, so they'll change and they'll disallow. Evangelical Christians voted 81-19 for Trump. We haven't seen numbers like that since Reagan. 81-19 for Trump. Trump is the most exposed creep on these matters that we've ever seen. We've never seen anybody like this ever before. And so if you're a Republican, what are you going to worry about?
And why, though? Just real quick, because it wasn't that Donald Trump appealed, obviously, to a Christian ethos. It's because Christians believe themselves to be under existential threat in this country and in the world.
And they are. But I'm just saying...
So it didn't matter what Donald Trump was.
Yeah, but it can't then re-matter.
Right.
I mean, that's where you can't suddenly say, well, I don't like that guy. He, you know, he talked badly about women on a tape. You just voted for a guy who talked badly about women on a tape.
Well, if Donald Trump fails, as you say, fails to deliver for his constituencies, why wouldn't it rematter?
Because once you let the genie out of the bottle, or let's use all the images we can, you cross that Rubicon, once you breach a social compact and you take the compact like a mirror compact and you shatter it on the floor, putting it back together is the work of generations.
Or we go forward with a kind of two-tier understanding. If you're a politician and have been in politics for a while, you're held to one standard. But hey, if you're a celebrity... You're a celebrity. Well, you know, of course he's a celebrity. That's of course they're going to have weird, ugly things in their past. He's an outsider. And this, I think, also incentivizes future celebrity candidates, because it's harder to find, especially now with the so much pervasive digital information, squeaky clean politicians.
I think that's what makes all of this so hard to accept, is because we had the soft bigotry of low expectations for Democrats. Democrats were expected to be morally repugnant, to not care about indiscretions like that, to put aside their values in order to assume power.
To be morally repugnant, but you know, well, I'm just saying
to
I'm
not
saying,
care but, you know, about that sort of yeah. thing. To,
they
to mobilize identity politics.
No, it was okay because they weren't hypocrites about right. it. Right. Okay, but now they are hypocrites about it. I'm sorry. That's the other thing that happened that I think makes Abe's point, which is that suddenly everyone turns into Mrs. Grundy. Like, it's one thing for me to say Donald Trump is unfit because of the Access Hollywood tape, but every single Democrat and liberal who's, you know, including like who said Trump is disgusting, who was defending Clinton in 1998, does not get to say that. I'm sorry. Like, their hypocrisy has now exposed them. That has made it impossible for them to speak. That's one of the reasons it didn't work, I think. Or the Access Hollywood tape didn't work, because that's the evil that Clinton did. Clinton lowered the expectations on the personal behavior of mm-hmm. politicians. Republicans still paid, Democrats didn't. And now Republicans will not pay. If you're Mark Sanford and you go have an affair somewhere, If you're Mark Foley and you like are making you're making passes at pages, you come out and say, "Hey, I'm gay, and I was just helping them transition to a better lifestyle."
This is a lesson in the virtues of Puritanism. You let it slide and it keeps sliding.
That's right.
And you end up with
not deviancy, but you know, you define deviancy down and it goes down. Yep. It climbing up, as I say, is the work of generations. That's a moral awakening problem that we face. But if you think about the insanity of the, you know, I have four children, you know, like sort of Republicans in the primary, like having wars over who had the more wholesome family, like that's over with. You can be anybody. You can do anything except maybe be like a murderer and, you know, and make a plausible case. If you can get, you can make a plausible case for yourself if you have something else going on. That's one of the reasons that this is so terrifying. So what's going to happen now? You're going to be an 18-year-old and you're at a party and you kiss a girl and she hauls you up on rape charges, but the president of the United States can do whatever he wants. So like kids... not famous people, somebody on Twitter who makes a bad joke about, you know, something going on in the airport and loses her job and her life, like, that's okay. Unknowns, kids, you know, kids at the Harvard soccer team who are, like, rating whether or not girls are pretty, which was the whole point of Facebook, they can be persecuted and destroyed, but our political leaders are now going to have a bye. Is that how we're going to live?
That's how we're living. I mean, as of 2016, yes.
Well, I mean, whose standards are those? Why are people going to live under this bizarre, you know, Puritanism on, you know, liberal Puritanism over here and sybaritic hedonism over here that's okay for anybody who has enough money to sort of survive the scandal? Enough fame or money or sort of social position or being able to hire a PR firm to throw dirt at the person who threw dirt at you. How is that going to work? So one of the many reasons that I am so disheartened today, you know, by the fact that Trump has won the presidency. Not that I would not have been disheartened by Hillary Clinton winning the presidency. And we should say, most importantly, that Hillary Clinton lost this race because she is a dishonest, scheming, idealist, dronish, characterless person who lied in front of the American people. She lied about Benghazi. She lied about the emails. She spent 250 days not talking to a reporter because she couldn't come up with a good answer about anything. She coughed and did all that weird smiling during the debates every time it came up. She is a person who put this country's national security at risk, and enriched herself using a public office to do so. She was also unfit for the presidency. Horrible, and it's a in that sense, it's a wonderful thing that she is not president, and she will not be president because she would have created a whole set of other conditions under which politicians would now be free. How is she going to police her State Department from having a guy who would like write you a check, the government of gutter writing your wife a check for $1 million as a present? The President of the United States' husband got $1 million check from gutter as a present. Why couldn't, you know, Secretary of State Jake Sullivan's wife get $1 million present? And then we're really living in a banana republic in the 19th century. Hmm. Or something.
A nation of people, not laws.
Well, we're getting there anyway.
Right.
One of the, to go back to a point that you made a while ago, which I think is kind of fitting because we kind of went full circle on this, is, you know, how does Donald Trump deliver, and maybe he doesn't. One of the figures who emerged in this, re-emerged in this election cycle, was Juanita Broderick, a person who alleges that she was sexually assaulted by Bill Clinton. She became
raped by Bill Clinton.
Sexually assaulted. That she came out and became a really public figure advocating for Donald Trump's election because she believes her character was assassinated by Hillary Clinton and deserves some comeuppance. And when Donald Trump won the election last night, Juanita Broderick was on Twitter and she said, when does it stop hurting? Does this help stop? Does this make it stop hurting? And no, it never stops hurting. And Donald Trump's election won't make you feel better about your lives. And that's going to be really tragic.
And this is the person who is writing the most wonderfully about this is Kevin Williamson at National Review, who has been making an object lesson out of the argument that if you look to politics for salvation, you are indulging in idolatry, you are seeking a false god. Politics will not heal you. Politics will not make your life better. Politicians will not save what ails you. And the horror of the Trump victory is that that's what he promised. I alone can solve. Well, if you're living a dead-end life, you know, if you're a person in the world of J.D. Vance's Hillbilly Elegy, Donald Trump cannot save you. Economic growth will help if he can produce it. A revitalized industrial base will give you opportunities that you might not otherwise have. But if you're sitting there smoking pot in one of the states that just, you know, liberalized marijuana use, you know, one of the, now we have like 4 or 5 states where you can basically smoke pot at will. You know, if you're like using opioids, if you're, you know, if you're living on your mom's couch playing video games, there is no salvation for you but the salvation of your own soul through, you know, personal growth. And it is a horror that we are now, that we have a president who is essentially, while Obama promised to heal the planet, somehow Trump has promised to heal the broken souls of the forgotten men and women of America. That's what he said last night at 3 a.m., I am the tribune for the forgotten men and women of America. Well, no, he isn't. He is just a guy who runs the executive branch. And they're not going to get what they want from him.
In fact, he promised them eternal salvation because he said, you will never be forgotten again.
Right. Well, the question is, who is forgotten in the course of this election? And I think one of the mysteries are one of the things that we're going to have to see, you know, what the future is going to tell is he also made all these other promises and that whole entertainment wing of the Republican Party is in love with those promises, right? Like mass deportations, like the wall, like all that. What happens then? You think he actually, Peter Thiel, the venture capitalist who made a speech about him at the National Press Club, said that his voters, that reporters in the media took Trump literally and reporters and voters took him metaphorically. They know he doesn't want to deport, you can't deport 11 million people. They know that he's not going to build a wall that's 20 feet high in Mexico. What he means is, illegal immigration is bad. It's illegal. I'm going to stop it. And, you know, I'm going to stop people from coming in and killing people. And I'm going to, you know, I'm going to make sure that these people don't come in and take your jobs. And how he does it or what the modalities are, they don't really care that much. Well, I don't know. Like, if you're Rush Limbaugh or you're, you know, Sean Hannity or you're Laura Ingraham, okay, so you're, you know, you've sort of like come under Trump's wing and you're sort of part of this weird Trumpian universe. But are your callers going to start saying, hey, where's the wall? Are your callers going to start saying, where are the deportations? I'm waiting for the deportations. I hate those Mexicans. Somebody just slammed into me in a car, doesn't have insurance, and he's a Mexican. And I said, get out of this country, and no one's doing anything about it. What happens then?
Well, I suppose it would depend upon whether or not he instituted some non-wall version of this metaphorical policy, you know, that satisfied
I don't think it matters.
Them to some degree.
I don't think it matters. I think everybody gets just to keep warm by their anger and their frustrations and the scapegoats. The Chinese, the Mexicans, everybody's going to be a problem. Everybody's going to be stopping him from realizing his objectives because there's always going to be some sort of enemy out there that he can mobilize frustration and anxiety
on. Well, see, this
is
interesting now. So let's end on this point. Because who was Obama's enemy?
Republicans.
Republicans were Obama's enemy, right? Trump's enemy, the others, no, the othering that Trump does. So the Trumpkins' enemy was Republicans also. So we had this weird thing where Obama blamed Republicans and the anti-establishment Republicans blamed Republicans and they blamed Democrats a little bit. So Republicans got 2/3 of the blame and Democrats got 1/3. Okay, so now Trump is not going to blame Democrats. He's a Democrat. He's not going to blame Democrats. Who's he going to blame? I say he has two possible targets for blame. One is all these people, right? The Mexicans, the Mexican government, the Chinese, this, and the Republicans. That's the thing. What happens? Is he going to be magnanimous and sort of not interfere with Paul Ryan becoming speaker? We don't know. Is he going to be magnanimous and let Mitch McConnell be Senate Majority Leader if there's a challenge to his right? We don't know.
I wanted a $1 trillion infrastructure plan, and these Republicans in Congress would only let me pass $560 billion with offsets and taxes, and that's, you know, that's why we don't have an unemployment rate that we wanted.
Nancy Pelosi, once again, to be Minority Leader of the House, tweets out this morning that she's excited to work with Trump on the infrastructure jobs bill. So the Republicans are like, wait, we can't spend $1 trillion in the first 2 weeks. We're Republican. We're not spending $1 trillion on an infrastructure bill. And he's like, okay, the Democrats are going to vote for it. So there we get it. So, and then what happens then? And it will always be the case for a guy like Trump and for anybody else that if he makes an enemy, if he decides to target establishment Republicans as his, so he can remain the anti-establishment guy, there will always be a ready and willing, not only conservative, Breitbartian media, but mainstream media that will jump right in on his side because that's whom they hate.
But what about the idea that presidents, by virtue of having won the election, should get their sort of two or three big things? They should have a shot they have a mandate for these things just because they were elected. Donald Trump's two or three big things are big crazy things, right? I mean, if it's the trade war and a wall, what does Congress do? Republican and Democrat.
Well, here's what he said: he wants an infrastructure bill, and he wants to repeal and replace Obamacare.
He called for a joint session of Congress in order to, which would really, really sandwich this era nicely, because the joint session of Congress in 2009 that Obama called in order to mobilize support for Barack Obama's health care reform initiative will be concluded with a joint session of Congress out of session to discuss repeal, I suppose.
So the question is, does he accept the off-the-shelf plan that Paul Ryan and others have come up with to repeal and replace Obamacare? And what happens then? And then, of course, we get the really interesting question, which is, it's a 51-49 Senate, Republicans in control of the Senate. Well, that's not enough to repeal Obamacare. So do the Republicans shatter the filibuster in order to replace Obamacare? Well, if they shatter the filibuster in order to replace Obamacare, suddenly Democrats are going to start screaming about shattering the filibuster. Who broke the filibuster in the first place? Harry Reid on judicial nominations. So we're in like a whole new universe in which we're going to have this entirely improvisatory president who has no history of hewing to, you know, traditions or political norms or anything like that. And this is the thing that alarms me the most as a practical matter, not the larger alarm that I have about the sort of the moral framework in which the country is now going to operate. But are we going to have systematic efforts to policy and scheduling and, you know, dealing with crises and how and have a proper way that crises are dealt with? Or is it going to be day by day and he's just going to get angry and start tweeting angry stuff at people and, you know, and staying up late at night and getting mad and, you know, giving speeches and trying to basically, you know, basically having obsessions about destroying Jeff Flake of Arizona and Ben Sasse of Nebraska, the two senators, and Lindsey Graham, who didn't vote for him, and just, you know, is that what is going to focus him, or is actually having, is he going to have be concentrated by the fact that he's now become president of the United States, and it's not just about building a building or about being on a TV show or about having a stake or about, you know, screwing with the tax system. And, you know, the uncertainty that is created by a person with the kind of personality that Donald Trump has and the way that he has behaved in the public eye really for the last 2 years is a sobering prospect for any maintaining any kind of assurance that the government is acting in a kind of sober and responsible manner, because you'll never know when he's going to go off. Has it ever happened? I mean, it's like it was happening with Nixon behind the scenes. We know that from the tapes and from the diaries and stuff like that. And then there's people he would like go off behind the scenes and say, I want you to arrest that guy. I want you to do this, you do that, do that. And then they would like, they wouldn't listen to him because they knew he was drunk or they knew, you know, he was just ranting. And but Trump can now go right to Twitter and change political reality with one word. Kind of scary. So we will be taking a break from podcasting next week because I am I'm out next week, and or you guys could if you want to, if something comes up that's worth talking about. I won't be here, but if Abe and Noah have something interesting to talk about, they certainly can do so. I don't think I'm really the most. It's not about me. That's what I'm saying. Thanks for listening. As we enter this new era, I hope that you will find Commentary Magazine a source of important analysis and fearless commentary. All we are going to try to do is tell the truth as we see it best. As you can tell, we are in a position of independence from the incoming president, but we are, and we are in a position of total independence from all sort of political trends in the United States or all partisan trends in the United States. And we will simply try to look at the world dispassionately and with fresh eyes from the perspective the commentary has always had, which is to defend the West and its institutions, to speak out for the United States and its role as the leader of the free world and the representative of what is greatest and best in Western civilization. And that's all we can do. That's what we do best. I think we do it well. Join us at commentarymagazine.com, where you get a few free reads, and then we ask you to pay $19.99 for a digital subscription, and $29.99 gets you all access, including our beautiful monthly magazine, delivered to your door every month, as it is a monthly. So thank you for listening. Keep the candle burning.